And welcome again, wrestling fans. Episode 712 of the Short Time Wrestling Podcast. I'm Hall of Fame wrestling writer, broadcaster, and announcer Jason Bryant. Today on the show, Sports Illustrated senior writer Pat Forty. Going to talk about covering the world of sports, but he's also going to talk about covering the world of sports with the background that he is a parent of an Olympic sports athlete, a non-revenue athlete, and actually not just an Olympic sports athlete, which is the term we use for non-revenue sports, which I hate the term non-revenue, but your wrestling, your swimming, your track and field and such, anything that's not football or basketball, essentially. And I realize that some places baseball is a revenue sport, and some places men's ice hockey is a revenue sport. Some places women's basketball is a revenue sport. That take that out of the, you know, the nuance. But Pat's a swim dad, and he's had kids that competed in college, and most recently his daughter Brooke is a swimmer at Stanford. She's an Olympic medalist in Tokyo. So he'll talk about being one of the few parents that actually had the opportunity to watch his daughter compete at the Tokyo Olympics. Because of COVID, well, you know, there were no fans, but he was a sports writer covering the Olympic Games. He talks about what it was like being able to cover that, the games, but also being able to watch, not as a sports writer, but as a parent, and basically kind of the weirdness that was Tokyo. Also going to get into that experience on what it means for covering college sports when you also have an interest in sports that other mainstream media outlets tend not to cover. A lot of Pat stuff is college football during the football season, college basketball during basketball season. It was a real fun conversation, and actually he's a guy I've enjoyed reading for a long time, and come to find out before we even started the show, we found out several mutual friends from my time in the print industry. Other things that are coming up on the docket, school starting for a lot of you parents, school starting for a lot of you wrestlers that listen to this show, and if you're a teacher, if you're a parent, if you're a kid, hey, good luck, have a safe and happy school year. My kids don't start for about another week and change, so we're about to jet off on vacation here for a bit to get the last bit of the summer, squeeze it out before we put the kids on the bus in the morning, and some of us go back to the daily, oh wait, there's no kids around the house, to actually get some work done. Speaking of work, things that we're doing here at the network, of course, the World Championship is coming up. United World Wrestling released its preliminary entry list. That is where me and Brian Hazard get to do the whole, get the hands moving. Obviously, this isn't the video portion of the show. You get the whole, like, all right, we dig into it. We get our bio information right to get ready to announce the World Championships coming up in Belgrade. So with that, I'm going to be able to pull all sorts of data and information out, and I'm going to be providing that to patrons of the Matt Talk Podcast Network. Now, I've implemented the Patreon plugin on matttalkonline.com, so there is bonus content that you can get through your Patreon login, and some of this stuff is on the actual Patreon page. And if you're not familiar with what Patreon is, it's patreon.com, patreon.com/matttalkonline, or you can go to matttalkonline.com/contribute. That's an easy way to get to it. That is how listeners can basically help this network stay up and running and help fund some of the time it takes to do a lot of these research projects and stuff. And in turn, those of you that do contribute, the things that I'm doing, the bonus material, the stuff that I do on my own, I give that to you as well. So it's not like you're funding me to do this research. I'm doing this research for the World Championships because I need it as the PA announcer. But I get to give it to you if you're contributing to the network. Other things that your direct contributions do help is basically spending the time on going through. Right now, I'm doing that whole deep dive into tracking down all the results. Well, I've taken a little tangent into that, something that Mark Cuban said kind of stuck in my head about spending time on one project versus 10 at a time, so one at a time. So I'm going down to Division III right now because I know my friend Jackie Paquette at the National Wrestling Coaches Association has a lot of the D2 work already done. So tabling D2, tabling the NAIA, because there's about a decade worth of results I've got to find before I can even transcribe them. But we get to Division III, so I'm through 1978. And one thing that I've already found is another set of eyes always helps. Now, I could offload this to some intern or something. Hey, I'll give you, you know, write you a recommendation or some credit. No, I'm a bit of a control freak when it comes to the data. Not because I need to have it. No, because I can go through it and I'm correcting it and I'm trying to find things that are wrong with the data as I go. So I see that said Creighton last match. Now it's Creighton. Like, which one is it? So I'm correcting names, trying to research. Okay, there's no first name here. I can't read that last name. Is this school here? So I go through and I dig through to find all these things to correct the data. And already in the first See, 1974, 75, 76, 77. The first 4 years of the Division III championships, I've won, added all the qualifiers that were the non-placers, but I've also found about 15 errors from the data, whether it be a name, misspelling. In some cases, I've corrected the school on where the All-American was attributed to, and I go back and look, well, where was that point of failure? That was actually entered wrong in either Amateur Wrestling News or the NCAA guides, looking at the brackets, and I'm cross, like, okay, let me double-check with that. For example, I did a super tweet the other day, which is another paid add-on if you want to contribute. It's where I put some other stuff out on Twitter. I'm just working with that. I'm still kind of new to it. There's really just two people that are subscribed to it right now. But I'm looking, it's like, okay, this guy was listed as Mansfield for a long time, and then so I was like, well, he's now listed as McMurray. Which is it? So I search and I see the bracket and it says McMurray. And I see there's another guy from Mansfield already in the bracket. I was like, well, which is it? So I go, well, the problem is McMurray closed. MCHighlanders.com doesn't exist. So off we go to archive.org. I find a page that's still in existence on the archive Wayback Machine. I was like, all right, where's the McMurray Hall of Fame? Is this guy, he's an All-American. He's probably in the Hall of Fame. And sure enough, Al Garber from Mansfield is actually Alan Garber from McMurray. So literally setting the record straight. That's what I've got going on. You can find out more about that type of stuff. And again, it's not just podcasting here. There's a lot of things I'm doing to further promote the sport of wrestling, but I have to sometimes go backwards to move forwards. And what I mean is we can't promote the sport's history if we don't have that history to look at. So a lot of brackets, a lot of PDF scrounging, a lot of schools that I never knew had wrestling programs, or there are schools that I had listed on my drop project that are like, oh, okay, here's where they were Division III. Oh, here's where they moved up to Division II. Oh, they came back, or here's a short time, no pun intended, that this school existed, like Boston State College. This is a school I actually didn't even know existed. It is now rolled into UMass Boston. Well, there were two different schools, and a merge, you got to treat a merge differently than a drop. So, you know, then there's Lowell Tech. Well, Lowell Tech merged with UMass Lowell. So now, or Mass Lowell, which is now UMass Lowell. So it's just all sorts of crazy stuff. And I'll break all this stuff out eventually. But as of right now, it takes a lot of time to do that. And again, that's where a lot of those contributions come in. So while I'm not prolifically putting out a ton of shows right now, there is work being done for the sport of wrestling. And your little contributions throughout the course. Right now, I got 74 patrons. Thank you very much. Some of you have gone back to 2015. So without your support, I wouldn't be able to justify my time to work on stuff like this. And I'd be, you know, who knows where I'd be. Anyway, enough about the geekery of the data, because this is the stuff that I tell my wife. She goes, okay, I don't want to hear anything about podcasting or wrestling stats. Okay. Yep. I drive her crazy when I find something new that just, oh my gosh, I didn't know this even existed. And it's like, oh, that's great, honey. No, I'm just kidding. Anyway, she's going to have a week of me not thinking about wrestling stats, which means it's going to be a week of me thinking about not thinking about my wrestling stats. Anyway, that's all I got. Pat 40 coming up on the show. You can follow him at by Pat 40. Man, at Sports Illustrated, good conversation. We spent a lot of time talking about just general sports, but there is wrestling ties throughout. And Pat's got a good head on his shoulders when it comes to understanding the plight of the non-football, non-basketball player. So that's what we've got now. As always, I'd like to thank you for spending your time with me, because you've always got time for short time. Now up on the Short Time Wrestling Podcast, going to jump away from the world of wrestling a little bit, but bring it back into our world of Olympic and non-revenue sports with Pat 40, senior writer from Sports Illustrated. Pat, first of all, welcome to the program. It's been a challenge to try to get you to answer these tweets, because you're a busy guy. This time of year, you're going to be even busier. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But we share a common bond when it comes to knowing one Mike Holtzclaw back in your days at University of Missouri and my days at the Daily Press. So before we get anything going with what we're talking about, if this is only for like three people. And so I want to know, what's your favorite Mike Holtzclaw story?
The Claw was one of the editors at the Man Eater, which was the name of the student newspaper at Missouri. Kind of like it's like the minor league paper, and then you go to the J school and you work for the J school paper. But the Claw was one of the rare adults, I guess you would say. At least he acted like it. He had common sense and like would, you know, like, okay, we need to actually work now to put out a paper and stuff while the rest of us were busy like trying to burn down the building and things. So enjoyed working with the Claw. He was a great guy, still is a great guy. And it's funny we have the common friend there.
Well, it's also really, you know, I see pictures, you know, his wife, Vicky, covered Old Dominion women's basketball and among other things. And, you know, I went to ODU. So her and I sat near each other at the press table over there. And then I worked with Mike at the Daily Press. Actually, he's the one who told me that there was a clerk opening at the Daily Press when I was working at a blimpy sub shop in Hampton, Virginia. He comes in. I go, Mike Holtzclaw. He knew me from announcing the games back at my high school. It's like, hey, you got, you know, I called him for some wrestling information, or I gave him some wrestling information that changed. He says, oh, by the way, there's a clerk opening here. I was down there that afternoon. And that's really how my journalism career began. So I've told you the short version of mine. I'm curious about how yours began. Colorado Springs native, going to Missouri. That's kind of the checks the box if you're a sports writer. If you're a broadcaster, it's Syracuse. If you're a sports writer, it's the University of Missouri. So was sports writing something you always wanted to get into, and Missouri the natural fit for that?
Yeah. You know, growing up, I played every sport, loved them all, and loved reading about sports. And I figured, you know, probably about my junior year of high school, I was not going to be a professional athlete. That was fairly clear. And so I was like, all right, what do you want to do? And then it just kind of seemed pretty natural. And my dad said, okay, well, let's look for journalism schools. And we looked at Northwestern and we looked at Missouri. And my point at that point was, well, Missouri's better in football. That seems like a more fun place to go. Saturdays will be fun. So that's why I went and chose Missouri.
See, now if you're making that decision, you're looking at like, how much is this going to cost?
Right. Yeah.
Sticker price.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure there was a big difference in cost then, but my dad, fortunately, like that wasn't part of the equation. He just said, you know, pick whichever one you think's best for you.
Well, there's always been the draw to sports. And one thing that you have discovered, actually, I'm curious on how you discovered it as a parent. Now, you're a swim parent, too, because if you've listened to, if you're familiar with Pat's stuff, he makes no qualms about how he's a swim parent. And the swimming parents, soccer parents, wrestling parents, cheer parents, there is a different culture when it comes to sports parents. And covering big time college football and then turning around to be a swim parent, what is the, I guess, the dichotomy in that type of relationship with one another?
Well, it is really interesting. You know, I mean, and yes, I can relate to probably a lot of the people that listen to your podcast and you interact with, because while it may be different sports, it's the same genre, so to speak, you know, and you're there and your kids are working incredibly hard and you're watching them and you're putting in your own hours, you know, transporting them and getting them around, usually bad hours, certainly for swimming, a lot of early hours. And then you just watch and you hope things go well. There's a lot of nerves, a lot of pride, a lot of excitement, but it's just so much fun to watch your kids compete and to have success and to grow bonds with their teammates and just see them grow through difficulty or whatever. I mean, all that stuff. So, you know, I think I can relate to parents of about any sport there. Being a sports writer and a sports parent is interesting. It's in most ways, it's not that hard to take off one hat and put on the other. The one thing that some people pointed out to me, like when I'm at a swim meet, I can flip into analytical mode pretty easily. You know, like I can sit there, watch without cheering, because that's what you do when you're covering an event. I can sit there and like take down everybody's times and say, okay, they're ahead of what, you know, their time, that was their entry time here. They're improving this and that. I was the guy on our club team that I was kind of in charge. I got the heat sheet out and I would tell everybody, all right, your daughter's in heat 3, lane 5. Your son's heat 6, lane 4. And I just kind of kept everybody abreast of what was going on there. And then I would tell them, hey, your son just dropped 2 seconds in the 200 butterfly. Congratulations. So that was kind of my role, where it's a little bit of my, I guess, my sports reporting background kind of bled into being a sports parent.
It's like akin to going to a baseball game and feeling naked without trying to keep scorebook at the same time. It's, you know, I was at a St. Paul Saints Columbus Clippers game 2 weeks ago, and I'm just like, where's my book? I just felt naked without tracking something. But yeah. I don't want to say you buried the lead on this, but the swim parent thing took a new turn last summer in Tokyo as your daughter came home representing Team USA with a medal around her neck. Talk about that experience a little bit and what that was like to kind of have the opportunity to witness.
Yeah, I mean, it was a lifetime thrill for sure. You know, mostly on a parenting level, but yeah, the crazy confluence of jobs there. For once, I shouldn't say for once, because there's always good things about being a sports writer. But you know, if your parents ever were like, "Oh, we wish you would have been a doctor or a lawyer instead, you're a sports writer." Well, for once, being a sports writer really paid off because nobody else could go other than the media, and so. You know, Katie Ledecky's parents can't be there, and Simone Biles' family, and Kevin Durant's, and all these, you know, all the famous Olympians. But I could be there and watch my kid compete. And so it was, you know, dream come true on two different levels. And fortunately, you know, Sports Illustrated, we had multiple people there. So the day that she actually competed, they're like, don't cover it. You don't have to write. And I was like, good, because I sure don't want to. I want to be here as a dad and just watch it. And you know, it was such a, it was overwhelming, the depth of feeling of it all. And just kind of each day leading up to it, it's like, you know, you walk into the venue, and this was my 9th Olympics, I guess. So I've been there and done that. And, but you walk in, it's like, my daughter's on the pool deck. Huh. My daughter's warming up. Look at the stands. Yeah. My daughter's sitting with all the other American Olympic team. Wow, yeah, my daughter's waving at Jill Biden, who's there, you know, representing the U.S. It's like, wow, all this stuff is happening. And then it's her day to compete, and that was just, you know, kind of a whole other level where, like, I had to it was a nighttime session because the clock was basically flipped being in Japan. I had to go outside and just kind of breathe, you know, like, this is really happening. My daughter is getting ready, who I've watched since, you know, swim competitively since she was 7, and before that since she was 1, is going to swim in the Olympics. And so I just sat out there and just kind of, like, I don't know, kind of almost tranced out. I like looked into the sunset and just like breathe, was just like, breathe, inhale, exhale, yes, this is really going to happen, how lucky are you? And went in and watched, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, because when we would leave the wrestling venue, you'd see the wrestlers walk around after they left the mat, and they'd stop at this video board, and where their family was looking at the other end. Mm. They did the best they can, because again to look at it from put the sports writer hat back on for a minute. How strange was it to look at things, and it's like, because swimming usually draws pretty well at the games; it's a pretty popular ticket. And wrestling usually does pretty well too. And I've got 300 people, and that's all the training people, the training partners, the other teammates in the wrestling venue. What's it like in swimming to be like, there's the cheering is really limited compared to what it usually can be.
Yeah. I mean, and this was, boy, it was a great venue. Beautiful. You know, I don't know what it would have held, 12,000, 50. I'm not sure. And so it's just a small fraction of that. You know, there's just the teams there. There's nobody else there. There's some workers, and that's it. And so that was strange and odd. And I felt badly for the swimmers to not get to experience that really electric atmosphere. But it was, you could hear what people were actually saying and who they were cheering for. And the swimmers themselves said, hey, that was kind of cool. We could, you know, you're standing behind the blocks and I can hear somebody say, hey, you know, go Caleb Dressel or something like that. And so that in a way, it was a little more personal, maybe a little more like an old school, like, you know, age group meet when these kids were growing up. But it was extremely surreal. And that I did break media protocol before Brooke swam, and I walked down just to the front of the press tribune, and I yelled what I've always yelled before she raced, which is go Brookie. You know, and that was it. But there was no other real, you know, there was a little bit of cheering here and there. But it was just such a different experience than anything you're used to at the Olympics.
Yeah, I haven't experienced anything like that as a parent. The closest thing in terms of breaking protocol, you know, being in the media is one way you have to act one way. Being in sports presentation, you have to act another way. And there's, you know, you're stoic, you're right where it is. I give everybody, as the announcer, the pop. But at the same point, I tell the story about Helen Maroulis when she won in Rio, and, you know, you're in tears. So the question here is take, you know, looking at it from an athlete's standpoint, not Brooke's experience, but have you ever been overcome in a moment like that by another athlete, somebody that you've known, you realize, oh, I got to correct this real quick, because I'm working here. I've got to be a professional, where emotion has gotten the better of you in a moment like that.
Yeah, I mean, outside of family, I'm not sure, like, to the point of tears, but sheer excitement for the drama of what you're seeing. I guess the three things I would say, all from Olympic perspective, 2008, when Phelps was trying to win 8 gold medals and did, but his second event was a 400 freestyle relay, and the Americans looked totally beaten with less than 50 meters to go. And that's when Jason Lezak swam this epic final 50 to somehow overhaul the French and out touch him by, I think it was 4/100ths.
The fingernail touch, right? Basically.
There was one of those too, but you jumped out of your chair like, oh my gosh, they did it. Like, you just couldn't believe that they got there first. And then later, Phelps' second to last swim was the famous fingertip touch in the butterfly when he won by 1/100th of a second, when he looked completely beaten on the last stroke. And I honestly think that Michael Cavic, who is from Serbia, who was swimming against, actually got there first but didn't hit the pad harder. Phelps hit it harder where he kind of glided in with his fingertips. But that was another one. You just jump out of your seat like, what? And then there's Maya Dorado in 2016, who has had a storybook career. She made one Olympic team, and that was it. She was going to retire after those Olympics. And her very last event, she had been chasing Katinka Hosu, and was second to her in the 400 IM and third in the 200 IM. And then they were facing off in the 200 backstroke. And she was behind the whole way. And the literal last arm stroke of not just the race, but of her career, won the gold medal. And she broke her fingernail there on the touch and won that one by, I think, like 6/100. So those were three instances where it was like, oh, my gosh. And I'm probably a little more emotionally invested in the swimming than the football and basketball, because I know these people and I know their sports so well, and I've covered the heck out of Phelps, and I got to know Maya Dorado really well. So those were really cool moments.
Yeah. So is this the most you're going to talk about swimming going into this weekend? Because now you're going to get headlong into college football. And as a college football fan, I went through one season of trying to cord cut and see what I could do to watch college football. It didn't happen because I'm kind of a sicko like you guys. I'll do it with wrestling during the wrestling season. But yes, I'm looking for that 10 o'clock game. I'm looking for that midnight Hawaii game. I'm on every streaming platform. It's like, all right, what's going on at Division II up in the Great Northwest Athletic? Just because there's got to be a game on during season for me. So how does this crazy time build up for you? Obviously, you get a little flavor of that on the podcast. But week zero is where we're going into. What is a typical Pat 40 week look like now that college football is starting?
Yeah, unfortunately, like the last couple off seasons have been like regular season because there's been realignment. There was the whole pandemic situation of, are we even going to have a season? I mean, we have written so much through the spring and summer in times when we usually don't. This year it was the Big Ten and UCLA and USC. So I'm really excited for the games just so we can write about something else and write about actual competition. Like week zero week this week, it's not that bad. Next week, yeah, we get going. And so for me, I write the 40-yard dash every week, which is a four-part column, notes column, basically a compendium about stuff all over the country. And that's big, heavy lifting on Sunday and Mondays. Do not bother me basically at all on Monday. Sunday, if you can give me 3 hours to watch the Broncos play, I would appreciate it. But otherwise, it's going to be a work day. And then Monday, 9 a.m. to midnight, basically, is going to be a real haul. We'll podcast Sunday night. We will podcast again on Wednesday. I will do Big Ten Network on Wednesday, usually trying to write another piece probably for Thursday. Sometimes it's Friday, and then Friday or Saturday, you're getting on the road and going to a game. So there's not a lot of downtime. I mean, usually if I can get a Friday off, that's good. But for about 15 weeks or so, it's a 6 to 7 day a week undertaking, which is fine. It's fun.
Yeah, you know, and you can hear your affinity for swimming coming through in the previous part of the conversation, but how much do you actually get to pay attention to things you're interested in during that season? Obviously, you know, we like sports, we're going to pay attention to sports, but, you know, you talked about the Broncos on Sunday, but is there anything else you get to do during those 15 weeks that says, you know what, here's something that's sports related, or I'm going to watch this swim meet, or I'm going to, you know, pay attention to what's going on outside of what I have to cover? I mean, do you have any time for that?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, and like I'll certainly watch whatever swimming's available, although it's going to be different. I mean, it was very easy to set the schedule based on when my kids were swimming and where. Now I'm a little bit more of a free agent. I can be a little more selective, I guess. And I won't be going to meets per se as much. But honestly, it's good for me to get into like a good book. So that just at the end of the night, I can stop my brain, you know, and like not be thinking about tomorrow's story or what needs to get done for this, or, oh my gosh, did you file that credential to go to this game or whatever, you know, all that stuff. Did you make your hotel reservation or not? So if you can give me a good, like, historical nonfiction book, read a lot about World War II, World War I, Civil War, some things like that, that gives me a good, like, turn off and kind of readjust for at least a little bit.
Coming through, I've got a couple books in my library that are various, you know, the collections of best American sports writing and such. And when you're a young sports writer cutting your teeth, who are your favorite people to read?
That's Rick Riley, who was at Sports Illustrated. And before that, actually, see, I claim squatter's rights on Rick. Everybody loved him when he was at Sports Illustrated. But he was covering the Broncos for the Denver Post in the early 1980s. When I was in high school. And so I was reading him then. And then he went to the Los Angeles Times. And back then, there was no internet. You figure you'd never read him again. So, you know, goodbye, Rick. And then he shows up at Sports Illustrated. It's like, oh, great, I get to read you again. So I loved him. He was very, very funny. And there were times I kind of probably tried to mimic his style. And I realized I wasn't really as funny as he was. So you kind of have to learn and live and learn and adjust. Who else? Alexander Wolf, who covered college basketball for Sports Illustrated in the 80s, and was just phenomenal wordsmith and was very nice to me when I was just starting covering college basketball, the Courier Journal in Louisville and in the late 80s. Just really a great resource and very friendly. Who else? Some people locally in Louisville, Rick Bozich, who was a columnist at the Courier Journal when I was first starting there, who was a great role model in how to be a columnist and how to not worry about, like, didn't suck up to anybody, called his shots and lived with people getting mad at him. And it's like, that's part of the job. Just wasn't beholden to anybody. So I liked the way he did his job. But, you know, you read so many people and you just kind of learn and borrow and steal from them about how they did their job.
Yeah, I was fortunate growing up. Obviously, I mentioned Holtzclaw, but M.A. Vocal was on the staff when I first started there. I had the Daves, Fairbank, Dave Johnson, David Teal, you know, Norm Wood was with me for a long time. So a lot of the guys that, you know, that are covering the Ryan O'Halloran, who covered your Broncos for quite a long time, Daryl Slater with the Jets. So, yes, I'm name dropping. But again, that early time in the newsroom really kind of in my case, it shaped you, and I can clearly tell it shaped you there. But when we go to the ascension, I guess, in some way, shape, or form, because print media really, it used to be, all right, I'm going to go file my 12 to 14 inch gamer. That's it. I don't have to do anything until the next day. Now you're filing a story, then you're filing an update to the story, or you're tweeting, live tweeting stuff. So the business of sports writing has changed. The outlets of sports writing might have the same names, but working for Sports Illustrated now is not like working for Sports Illustrated in the 70s. So what was it like to get that call from SI, and what made you jump at it and knowing things are changed?
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. I mean, my career path, I went from the Courier Journal in Louisville. I was there for 17 years and loved it. It was awesome. And then it's funny. I got in this. I just got a calendar alert that we're supposed to start the podcast in 10 minutes. If
All
the
right,
backstory
great.
For the listeners here is I jumped the gun and thought it was 10:30 Eastern. It was actually 10:30 Central. So that was my fault. But anyway, we're taping, so we're good.
A little behind the curtain there. Yeah.
Yeah. There's your behind the curtain.
It's not midnight and you're not in Salt Lake City after watching a Mountain West game or something.
That's right. Anyhow, so I was at the Courier for 17 years, newspaper. That's all I ever wanted to do, all I figured I would ever do. And then things started to change, and the internet came along. And I went to work at ESPN and worked for ESPN.com and did that for 7 years, and most of it was great. And then I went to Yahoo for 8 years, which was solely online and solely a tech company and very different. But then Sports Illustrated, I mean, like, I grew up reading that magazine, and that's a place that I had always wanted to work. And so when they called and they made a very good offer, I was like, yeah, I'll do it. And it's been great so far, 3 years in. It is different, obviously. Yes, it's more of a website than a magazine now. We still do have a magazine. We publish monthly. The football preview is out now. NFL on one side, college on the other. We got a flip cover, so it's pretty cool. But, you know, it's, I mean, the nature of the business has just changed radically, and I'm sure there are more radical changes to come. But, you know, you can't stand still and just sit there and say, gosh, I sure wish it was like the old days, or else you're going to get left behind.
Yeah, the evolution of it. And part of that is the podcast. I've been doing podcasts since 2008 and been on a radio since I was in high school.
Wow.
So I'm curious, is the, you know, how the podcast world is kind of infiltrated. It used to be, okay, the online is now infiltrated the print. And then it was a blog has infiltrated the online. Then it's, all right, tweeting has infiltrated our coverage. Now it's a full, robust multimedia offering. And, you know, you've doing the show. It was you, Pete, and Dan initially. And then the names have changed basically depending on who's guilty or whatnot. But now Ross is in the mix. And, you know, a little bit about the Yahoo Sports Illustrated relationship there. I mean, it's the Yahoo's podcast, yet you're writing for SI, having worked for Yahoo. How does that relationship work? And then talk a little bit about what's the podcast really meant for the coverage for both Yahoo and SI?
Yeah, it's a good point. And I mean, podcasts are incredibly popular. If you've been doing them since 2008, you are like the pod father. I mean, you go way
back. I think Adam Curry has the title there. I've put over 3,000 episodes out. But yeah, I think podcasting people, you say pod father, they're like, no, Adam Curry, because he kind of invented it, air quotes. So,
yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, it's great. I mean, it's just, to me, it's a lot of fun because I get along with these guys so well, you know, and worked with Wetzel and with Pete Thamel at Yahoo. And when I left, that was the one thing we were like, hey, can we work this out where I can studio the podcast? And all sides were fine. Sports Illustrated was very gracious about it. Like, yeah, you know, it's a pre-existing thing and it's been popular. And so very, very happy to continue to do it. It has been... it's been wild to watch that grow. You know, we had, I think, a niche following kind of in 2020, and then 2021, things really started to step up. Realignment was big. But then this year, wow. I mean, we're like doubled our audience. And you get a, I don't know whether it's a different following, but people seem to attach a little bit more, I don't know if it's emotionally or what, when they can hear you. Whether it's just you're a little more relatable or something than you are on the page as a written word, but the people that like the podcast really like the podcast, you know. So you probably know. So our feedback has just been fantastic. People like, you know, we do obviously a lot of sports and a lot of issues in sports, but people really like the dumb stuff that we do about, you know, idiot people and chicken sandwich wars and animal attacks and. So we just really want to have as much fun with it as we can, because that seems to be what people are looking for out there.
What I love about it is again, there's the goofiness to it, because so many talking head shows or talking head podcasts or, you know, three guys, one brain kind of thing shows out there, you get, you know, okay, there's a little bit of humor, but it's, you know, the talking head, the facts, that's okay. You guys drop the facts, the stats, and your personal experiences with it, along with your sense of humor. And that's something that I find refreshing about it, because, you know, it's, I don't know if it's part of this don't meet your hero stuff and you realize they're kind of like you or they're kind of not like you, but, you know, you'll hang around. Like, I remember back to my days in the newsroom, I'd see Skip Miller's picture, our editor, on the column of the Daily Press. I'm like, man, that guy's cool. And I go in and actually start working there, and he's just sitting there just laughing at himself. He told himself a joke or something. It's like he's sitting there. And, you know, it's just that it shows that, you know, the people that have to cover this stuff are real people too. It's not just this entitled, I get a press credential to go everywhere too. But, and having lived a little bit of it also kind of helps, at least for me. But, you know, when it comes to competitive, the competition for the ear, I'll say this, and this isn't just blowing smoke. When that thing drops, that is the first thing I listen to. I usually listen to it right as I'm going to bed. Sometimes I have to set the timer to make sure I don't sleep through it and have to go back and re-download it again. But I just like the banter because I guess maybe it speaks to just my travels and such. You know, I've been to three Olympic Games. I've covered, big college wrestling events. And, I've spent some time covering college sports other than wrestling. So I just think, as here's some listener feedback, I freaking love the show. Don't change a thing. So,
I think your
producer does a great job, too. I just, I love that. Just that whole dynamic of the show is something that I'm really glad that there's a group of professional sports writers out there doing something that's a little bit, not so buttoned up all the time. So I personally love it in that regard.
Yeah, well, thank you. I do appreciate that. And that's one of our goals, is just not to take it that seriously. I mean, we try pretty hard to not prep very much and just kind of wing it,
Kind of flies in the face of what you're taught, right?
Yeah, right. But it's like, this should not be this serious an endeavor. And if we get on here and sound like we've rehearsed everything and like, okay, you're going to say this and then I'm going to say that and da 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 da, then it's like, it's not really a conversation. And again, it's like people, I think, want to come and maybe get a little bit of information, but also have some laughs. And so if we can provide that, then right on.
Now, moving to the next thing I want to get into is, you guys talk about so many topics when it comes to Division I sports, mainly college football and basketball, but you've got that swim background. You've got that parent of an Olympic sport. And I hate to use the term non-revenue, but that's how many people look at it, especially when it comes time when they drop the hammer and drop in sports. They don't bring any money. Well, if you're a college sports fan, strictly because of the revenue a sport brings in, then you have like two teams you could probably root for ever, because college sports are pretty much a losing proposition. Part of that makes me wonder, and why I wanted to have you on, is you've got a distinct viewpoint on the non-revenue, the Olympic sports athlete, that I don't feel like a lot of journalists have, and they don't spend a whole lot of time talking about how is this impacting the wrestlers? How is this impacting the swimmers, the track runners? So how do you kind of fight maybe trying to get that message out without coming off like a biased sports parents in the process? Because we had I was tracking all these drops during COVID. 456 sports were dropped from 113 schools across all divisions. We usually just heard, 40 schools. I was like, no, it's more than just Division I. There's more than college sports than just Division I. There's more to college sports than football and basketball. So what are the important topics you'd like to get out more that are relevant to the sports fan, and the sports fan in the SEC should be paying attention to, despite what Nick Saban's contract is or how much the A&M's throwing at the NIL?
Yeah. I'm glad you kept track of that, because somebody needed to. And again, to provide the reminder, at least, that
Ross even gave me a shout out in his story. I was like, yes, yeah. SI's mentioning it. Sweet.
Yeah. That college sports is more than 65 football programs, it's more than 68 making the NCAA basketball tournament. There's so much more to it, and always has been. That's the thing that kills me, Jason, is this whole idea, well, we don't have enough money. Well, back when football was making one-tenth of what it's making now, there was enough money to have these other sports. So what's changed? It's football just keeps spending and spending and spending and resenting sharing any of the money with anyone. It drives me crazy. There are so many great human interest stories and high achieving, hardworking athletes in Olympic sports. I mean, that's all I've always said about covering the great thing about covering the Olympics is you meet these people who, A, they're not spoiled. B, their stories haven't been told a million times. They're fresh. They have good perspective. They're interesting. Most of them have gone to school to actually go to school. They're well educated. I find it really just so refreshing when you get to an Olympics and get to cover those people. And that's not to say you don't get great people to cover in football and basketball too, but there's such a cynicism and a guardedness and everybody's been commoditized in football and basketball, so that you lose some of the human perspective and you lose some of the just pure competition perspective that you can still find in all those other sports. And again, look, I mean, it is hard to train to be a wrestler. It is hard to train to be a swimmer. It's hard to train cross country, those sorts of things. The demands are high. You got to love it. And you're doing it again for more than just, hey, can I get rich off of this? Because most of the time you're not. So I have great respect for those people. And yeah, the thing that just gets lost in this is like, we've got to have another facility for football. We've got to have 8 more staffers. We've got to have this. We've got to have that. Well, what's getting lost is the Olympic sports. And those people go to, like, when the athletic
department they're your donors. Your donors.
Right? They're the ones that are going to graduate. They're going to graduate with high GPAs. They're going to get good jobs, and they're going to come back and be donors. I mean, all those things are true. And yet the short-sighted rush to, we have to coddle football, we have to enable football more, cost has an incredible cost throughout the rest of the athletic department and the university. I mean, the higher GPAs tend to be in those sports, higher than the normal student GPAs tend to be in those Olympic sports.
Yeah, looking at now, wrestling didn't get hit as hard as I was fearing when COVID hit. Of course, my alma mater was the first Division I to drop at Old Dominion. And it should be noted, I think I've called and emailed and left messages for the outgoing and new president in the last 2 years, and I've received exactly one reply that was a forward to the AD who dropped the sport to begin with. So I'm not getting anything as an alum or a journalist. So, you know, it's funny, the Virginian Pilot back, and I'm going to throw a little shade at them, have done nothing to actually investigate this story other than say, oh, we talked to the president, there's no story there. So, yeah, great research there. So they absorbed my former rag. So a lot leaves to be desired with that story. But when we go back to me arguing with my people from my alma mater, and, you know, the story is, well, nobody cares about wrestling, or more people like football, more people like baseball. That's why I didn't get cut. It's not about, I mean, college sports, if it was about what the masses like, you'd have 2 sports, you'd have no women's sports, you'd have, I mean, it's just, and, you know, and I don't mean that disparaging towards women's sports, because I covered a lot of women's college basketball. I covered a lot of women's sports. My, you know, I'm planning a women's college wrestling tournament. I mean, I've been to 20 some straight junior women's national championships. So, but I'm saying is like, if like reading the comments is probably the problem, message board geniuses, for example, but you know, oh, nobody goes, well, you know, swimming's not a huge draw when it comes to spectators at the college level. Swim meets are crazy fun when there's a dual meet, especially because you can get the teams in there and they taunt each other with the walkout music and all that stuff. But what drives me nuts is, why are you a college sports fan, or are you just a football fan at your university? I feel like I'm talking to a wall sometimes when I'm trying to say, look, your reason you're Division I is because you have these other sports. Don't forget that. Maybe it's time to support them. But when it comes back to Old Dominion, saved $1 million with a consultant who's a former basketball coach who runs a basketball coaches convention that said, give $1 million to basketball. So, you know, what is the school better for this? Well, football, you brought in $45 million. You spent $47 million to do it. So now my numbers, maybe I'm just kind of spitballing the numbers there. But from a caste system is how I've always kind of described it. It's like, okay, I don't feel the football and basketball player is any more important as an individual to the student body than any other athlete. We talked about cost of attendance was a big thing before NIL was even a thing. And I'm sitting there looking at my roommates on the wrestling team. It's like, cost of attendance, the full ride athletes got better scheduling opportunities. They got, you know, better living off campus. Like, basketball got to stay in the upperclassmen dorms because they didn't have to go home. They had to games during a break. Whereas, like, the wrestlers, you don't want to know what we were using coffee filters for. You don't want to know what type of crap jobs we were doing. So it's like, oh, it can't work. All these non-revenue athletes, all these Olympic sports athletes, they're having jobs. So, you know, to say the college football and basketball athlete, oh, they need all this, and this. The money needs to go to the people that actually need it. So that need-based, you know, cost of attendance kind of thing also kind of rubbed me the wrong way a little bit as I'm ranting. But again, daughter's a swimmer. You've seen some teammates, whether they're at Stanford, whether they're other places where she swam growing up, that struggle. Like, these college athletes that are on full boats don't understand.
Absolutely. No, and that's, yeah. I mean, you're talking partial scholarships for almost everyone. And that's, I had 2 sons that swam as well. And the 3 of them all had varying amounts of financial aid, you know, not everybody gets everything paid for. That's a privilege that belongs to the football, basketball realm and a couple select other sports, but you have to get by on what you've got, and then, yeah, make it up wherever you can, whether that's a job, whatever the heck the case is. But the fact of the matter is, of, you know, there is a storyline that went out, and there, I understand it, okay, of the exploited college athlete, and it was all about football and basketball. And again, I get it because of the revenue versus, you know, what the coaches were making versus what the players got. So I understand that. But in terms of exploit a college athlete, there's a lot of people that are, hey, you're paying for my books and I'm otherwise scrambling and hustling to get everything else done. And our training facility sucks. And we don't get the training table food because that goes to the football team. And we don't get the good travel. We are on a bus for 6 to 8 hours. You know, all those sorts of things that
you guys don't even use that pool table. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's not even get into the waterfall and the pool table and the barbershop. Yeah,
I'm going to stay away from the practice facilities I've seen at the Division I institutions that I've had a chance to tour. And of course, they all have wrestling, so I'm not going to throw them under the bus here. Now, one of the key points that has me tuning into you guys, that has me reading Matt Brown's Extra Points newsletter, that has me paying attention to realignment Twitter, if you will, if that is a thing, is the impact that realignment and this conference shifts are going to have on the non-revenue sports. Because, you know, look, I put out a renovation of college wrestling a couple weeks ago to look and say, hey, what can wrestling do? Because we've contracted down to 7 conferences. Believe there's still a moratorium on single sport conferences and creation of new ones. But it's like, how can we get more conferences? And I expanded it and I was like, all right. And I looked at it and it says, it's only going to take one mid-major move to screw all this up. And of course, without fail, Campbell jumps from the Big South to the CAA. Mm-hmm. So, but in terms of what it's going to take, because in wrestling, UCLA and USC going to the Big Ten had everybody, are they going to have to add wrestling? Are they going to have to add wrestling? No, it's not a required sport. It's a myth in wrestling that it's just, oddly enough, the Big Ten, since its creation is the Western Conference, every single team has always had a wrestling program. It's just, it's the unicorn in that regard. USC and UCLA, do they add wrestling? Probably not. Can they afford it? Probably. Are they going to come up with excuses not to add it? Probably. But the impact on baseball, the impact on men's and women's soccer, lacrosse, these schools that then get shifted out of a natural geographic rivalry, that was part of Old Dominion. They moved to Conference USA. Oh, there's no wrestling here. Well, you put them there. You put 6 sports into affiliate membership. So it feels like there's 2 issues, and the transformation committee has been, that's what's going to happen. What's going to happen? What's going to happen? So I'm just going to ask you, what do you think is going to happen with the transformation committee when it relates to Olympic sports and non-revenue sports? And what do you think your best practice would be to say, hey, here's the way to fix this?
Yeah, nothing good's going to happen with the transformation committee. I mean, maybe I'm too cynical, but I have seen the way everything has trended for 20 years now. It is all trending towards bigger football, bigger conferences. That's all that matters. Even basketball has kind of been, you know, just thrown out to a degree in terms of a differentiating factor. So, you know, what the Big Ten is now going to do is going to be, I think, the ultimate disservice to Olympic sport athletes. Is you are going to be asking them to either take on ridiculous travel hardships, and, you know, from a academic, physical, and mental health standpoint, you are going to be asking them an incredible amount, or you're going to fund travel in a way you never have for those programs. I happen to have an idea which way that's going to break. It's not going to break in the direction of the non-revenue sports. It's going to break in the direction of, well, suck it up. And they will attempt to schedule some things. You can do some things creatively with scheduling, like, hey, we'll bring 4 teams from the Midwest and USC and UCLA to Denver, and we'll play, you know, whatever the sport, volleyball, we'll play each other, like, you know, 8 times in a weekend or whatever. Well, fine. I'm not sure that's a good service to actually making your program better, but that you can do those kinds of things from a travel standpoint. But the transformation committee is finding ways to separate football further, okay, and to separate the power programs further, and to basically satisfy their needs and to sell to everyone else as well. This will then allow you all to govern yourselves. Okay. That's fine if it's actually going to work out well. But basically what it's going to boil down to is just a further stratification of football matters the most by far. These schools that play football at a high level matter the most by far. And everyone else, yeah, y'all just good luck. But this is where we're going to go, and this is where we're going to put all of our resources.
And if you're an athlete in this situation, look at where the growth is coming with sports. We added three men's and women's wrestling teams yesterday, two at Frostburg State, one at Alfred State. There's been, I think we're up approaching 350 new men's and women's college wrestling teams since in the last 20 years. We're getting to the point where there's going to be soon more college wrestling teams now than there were in the heyday in the 70s. And of course, a lot of that has to do with the 127 women's college wrestling programs. But the growth is Division II, Division III, the NAIA, where these enrollment-driven schools are adding. The opportunities are there. Yet, for some reason, the football and basketball mindset is drilled into every athlete of every sport, saying, oh, well, you got to go Division I or nothing. Values in college sports are values in college sports. So, and this is, again, something that doesn't get written about by big-time college sports writers because it's all football and basketball. If you could write a column and say SI is going to run this thing, no matter what your topic, and it's all going to be about non-revenue sports, Olympic sports athletes, and choosing a path. What is kind of your advice, or what would you like to inform the masses who have no idea going into, say, reading this hypothetical column?
Yeah, I mean, I just think that there is value in athletics, for one thing, and whether it's college or not, but if you can carry that value, the joy of your sport and what you get out of it to a college level, good, do it, and help those universities, hopefully help people pursue those things. Because for me, look, like I said, I was a high school football and basketball player. I got a lot out of it. I loved playing, and I do think that I learned a lot of life lessons that helped me. I wasn't going to do either of those in college. And I did have some small college football opportunities, but who cared? I knew what I wanted to do. Some other people, look, that if you want to keep going, you want to be a soccer player, D3 soccer player, like a niece of mine has done that, do it. If you want to swim D3, I've got a nephew that's going to go do that. Do it, because I think it rounds out your experience. And so I hope the schools, again, continue to provide the opportunities for people to do those sports, and that athletes pursue them, maybe not to the exclusion of anything else. I mean, I do think you should pick your school based on academics. And if the athletics are a nice fit with that, do it. But that's, you know, my oldest son, who was a little more than a walk-on swimmer at Missouri, but he wanted to go to journalism school. So his choices, much like mine, were Missouri or Northwestern. And he was just going to choose, journalism, and then we'll see how the swimming piece fits in. But he's really glad it fit in. All of his best friends from college, he's now 27, are all swimmers. So the bonds that you make on a team, high school, but I think especially in college, when you're kind of out from under your parents and they're not orchestrating everything for you, and you are finding your way through not just your sport, but your academics and living on your own and becoming an adult, are huge. And if you get those bonds from being on an athletic team, whether it is, again, NAIA, D3, D2, D1, whatever, I think it's a great thing.
Yeah, and another point we like to bring up in the wrestling world is, where are our high school coaches coming from? Your high school wrestling coach, unless you live in certain pockets of Pennsylvania and Iowa, is not going to be an NCAA champion. It's going to be the guy that was on the team at a mid-level Division I or wrestle D2 or D3. Like, you look at Pennsylvania's high school coaching, the wrestling is so good there. Well, there's a ton of college wrestling programs there. Then they come back and teach. Or in Iowa, there's all these Division III schools in the American Rivers Conference, and all those coaches that are at these good high school programs, they all wrestled there and had an experience at the Division III level. But also, to the point about your son, looking at my college experience, I didn't wrestle, but I was roommates with the wrestlers, but I was also roommates with women on the sailing team. But the social constructs of who were we hanging out with? We weren't hanging out with, we didn't have football yet, but, and we weren't, the men's women's basketball team were kind of off on their own islands most of the time, but it was the swimmers and divers. It was the wrestlers, the soccer players, the women's lacrosse team. I mean, it was all those non-revenue, those Olympic sport athletes tended to bond together because they had the same struggles. None of them, hardly anybody, I think, was on a full ride back then. So, it's not just your teammates. It's the people that are tied to the program. I mean, your other sports friends. I mean, there are people that got married from other sports that are their lifelong friends that go back home 1,200 miles. And they're, you know, like you said, they're teammates and friends or neighbors. They their kids play together now. So it's nuts. I mean, my college roommate married a women's soccer player. So, you know, it's the next generation coming through. So it's all about that experience as well.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's the thing, the shared experience that athletes have. And that's, you know, Stanford's got a huge athlete population, but a great community, you know. And like my daughter, when she'd come home, she'd be like, oh, we got to turn on Stanford's playing volleyball. Like, you know, my friends are playing volleyball. We need to watch that. Women's soccer. I got friends there. I got, you know, gymnasts. She lived with a couple gymnasts for a while. I think everybody kind of understands, and you could say the struggle everybody goes through, but that's kind of probably making it a little bit too dramatic. But the experience of, I'm going to go to school, I'm going to work hard academically, but I'm also going to have this other really important, fun, challenging, hard thing to do, and we're all going to bust it together. And that's a lot of times who you end up gravitating to and hanging out with.
All right, you mentioned Stanford. I want to circle back to that, because the 11 sports that were dropped and then brought back, I mean, we're talking about a school that has so much money. And say, oh, well, we want to downsize. I mean, you're on the front lines of this stuff. What were some of the things that you heard were just so absurd about Stanford's excuses, and then ultimately when they got saved? And I know Shane Griffith winning a national championship in a black singlet with no Stanford anything on it. Wrestling people like to wave the flag that Shane was a big part of why the sports got saved. But, you know, I mean, it just seems absurd that a school like that can't afford it. And of course, the alternative is, well, we're not a charity. Well, they're paying tuition, right? They're paying to go to your expensive school. So I just want to get, you know, kind of come back and, I don't want to say rehash, but, look at it, a redux perhaps for a better term, of how the Stanford thing came and went from your viewpoint.
Yeah, that was wild. And I mean, shocking. And I think it was a panic move, and they realized that and walked it back. And if you look at the number of schools that panicked during the pandemic, and the first response was cut sports, you know, I mean, you look at the revenues people are getting now, all 2 years later, Iowa, which cut swimming, Michigan State cut swimming. Oh, now you're going to get $1 billion a year for your conference, which is going to trickle down to $78 million a year just from media rights for your school. But in 2020, oh my God, we can't make ends meet. Oh no, we're going to have to cut sports. It's because you wanted to cut them anyway. You didn't want the sports. So that's, you know, that whole thing was very off-putting. As far as Stanford, yeah, the disconnect there is, I mean, you look at, they have a $28 billion endowment.
That's with a B, folks. B. We don't know this money. You can't comprehend this amount of money.
No, you absolutely cannot. But, you know, the endowment can't be touched. It almost all of it has been earmarked specifically by the donors. It's going to this. It's going to that. And almost none of it at Stanford goes to athletics. All right. You know, they're endowing, you know, jet propulsion laboratories and atom colliders and you know, whatever the latest tech stuff is. So you can't look at the endowment and say, well, save sports with that. It would be nice if that worked, but it doesn't work out that way. Stanford absolutely has the money for the sports, but they do not run on the same sort of budget as Ohio State or Texas. All right. They don't. They do not spend as lavishly. And I can tell you, I've been in the women's swim team has won more national championships than anybody. They put out, you know, scads of Olympians. Their locker room ain't much. They don't eat at the training table. The football team eats the training table. The women's best swim team, like once a week, I think they get training table. So, you know, there's some stuff that they do relatively inexpensively because they know that they can, and still everybody's going to want to go there for the education, right? And so you can get away with that. But there still is no reason to have claimed the poverty that they did to cut those 11 sports. And I'm very glad they reversed it. And yes, the wrestling statement, I think, was huge in terms of reversing that decision.
Yeah. I mean, Jason Borelli, you know, they showed him the door. He left before they showed him the door. He had to he took another job at American University, because, you know, when they brought it back, they're not going to keep the staff. They cleaned house on the staff, actually went and hired Rob Cole, the head coach at Cornell, who'd done a great job there. So they've got a fresh lease on life, so to speak, with the programs there. But Pat, in the time we got left, I just want to circle back to the plight of the non-revenue athlete, I hate saying that word, but it's been in our vernacular. How do we get, I guess, better awareness about these athletes and their stories? Because I'll sit there and I'll pitch back in the day, pitching a wrestling story. Well, it doesn't sell papers. It doesn't read clicks. Well, we're finding that Big Ten viewership, like Big Ten Network viewership, wrestling is pretty high. It's like when you put something out there, you know, it's a chicken and egg scenario maybe, but how do I politic Pat Forty to get more wrestling in SI? Yeah. We've had one wrestler on the cover. He's right there. Dan Hodge in 1952, although my stepbrother's uncle played football at Tennessee. He did wrestle. He was on the cover of 66. I want to count Frank Emmanuel as a wrestler on the cover, but the only wrestler on the cover is Danny Hodge. 52. I mean, there's no more cover anymore the way it is, but how can the wrestling community do a better job at maybe beholding itself to the mainstream media, other than the rare two-sport athlete? Oh, he wrestles and plays football. So, I mean,
right.
I guess every sport asks this question in some way, shape, or form. But, you know, wrestling, we're a sport that we do very well when we're put on TV. But other than that, we're kind of an insulated sport. We cover ourselves.
Yeah, no, I understand. I truly understand from a swimming perspective. I mean, you can try to get people interested and get people to read the stuff, but if it's not an Olympic year, and even to that degree, if it's not the Olympics, it's hard. It's very, very hard. People resist paying attention to it. And like you said, now look, there are places, pockets. I mean, yes, wrestling and hockey in the Big Ten, people will watch, people will go, people are into it. And probably like the pitches need to start there, you know, the Big Ten Network, which will do some televising and that stuff. But if you can get them to piggyback content of here's the feature story on this guy at Penn State who's this unbelievable story, great wrestler, whatever the case may be, and then just kind of try to extrapolate from there. We've got an Olympic editor. I will pitch to her. But again, like one of the things is now that we have, you can get every metric in terms of readership, people will not read it unless it's an Olympic year. I know this. I've written these stories, and I've seen the reaction and the lack of reaction.
In wrestling's case, you've got a guy like Gable Steveson who signed with the sports entertainment world, and that crew comes over to start reading about, you know, wrestling and the Olympic and collegiate style of things.
Yeah. Now, if you can do that, hey, awesome. I mean, you know, whatever works, whatever will get people to at least slow down, watch your sport and appreciate it, good. But it is difficult, I acknowledge.
Pat Forty's been our guest, senior writer from Sports Illustrated at By Pat Forty on Twitter. It's right there on the screen if you're watching the video. Pat, anything else you want to throw at us? Pitches for the podcast, perhaps? Because, I guess based on season, again, its name's changed. So right now we're the College Football Inquirer, are we not?
College Football Inquirer, yep. You can get it on, you know, Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever place you get podcasts. You can get the links also on Yahoo Sports at this point. Myself, Dan Wetzel, Ross Dellinger. We're just getting cranked up for the season, so by all means, please give us a listen and hopefully have a laugh with us.
I appreciate the time. Thank you very much.
All right. My pleasure, Jason. Thank you.
The Short Time Wrestling Podcast is proudly outfitted by Compound Sportswear. Shirts, singlets, custom gear orders, everything you need. Call up Cliff and the crew at cmpteamwear.com. Hey, you know what? Did you like the show? You want to hit that subscribe button? MattTalkOnline.com/listen. Various different ways to subscribe to this show on your favorite podcatcher of choice. And if you're already subscribed and you're already listening, you love the show and you want to support this show and this network, MattTalkOnline.com/join the team. Become a team member today.